Hello, I'm Tom Weber. Thanks for listening to NPR News here on the radio or online, or I hope you catch us on the podcast. This hour, you and your thoughts on the state's future. It turns out that while we as a state are very divided on many issues, we're still overwhelmingly hopeful about Minnesota's future. Those conclusions are from a new survey by NPR News and the APM Research Lab, which was created in the past year here at NPR. We asked more than 1,600 people across the state about their families and jobs and neighborhoods and outlook on life. And it's a survey that's part of a year-long project called Ground Level, which is an effort to deeply understand the people who make up our state. So to get a sense of a little bit more of what we're talking about here, I'm first joined by Craig Helmstetter, who is the managing partner of this research lab here at the APM Research Lab. APM is the parent company of NPR. Craig, good to see you again. How are you?
Great to be here, Tom.
We've had a lot of meetings about this over the last few weeks. Just overall goal and mission with even doing this survey.
Really to just dig in and understand what's going on with Minnesotans throughout the state. We were careful to want to represent, you know, every part of the state from northern to southern and everywhere in between.
Now, we will be focusing on this hopeful question in a moment, but just broadly, what stuff did you get into? This was something where it's like a 40-minute call if you were one of these people.
It's not that long.
All right. Yeah. In my mind, it was that long.
Yeah. It seems like it with all the information that's coming out of this. But yeah, we had 1,654 Minnesotans participating in the survey. Thank you very much if anyone listening happened to have taken part in the survey. And it covers, you know, a whole range of topics from how you think you're doing on your personal finances to how you think the state of Minnesota is doing on a variety of issues, and to even some political evaluations that we'll get into at some point.
So the question here that has a lot of focus today, and again, we're going to be talking about these on this show for the next 3 days. So we're diving into this because there's a lot to chew on there. This question came up: when you think about Minnesota, are you generally hopeful or fearful about the future? Big picture, what did we find?
Big picture, we found that 82% of Minnesotans said that they were hopeful and only 15% said that they were fearful about their state.
How does that break down? We did this by race, by geography, by gender. We did a whole bunch of assortments. You did a lot of numbers crunching. Break that down for us a little.
Yeah. You know, let me just pause a little bit before we get into the breakdown, because I think if your listeners are at all like me, you hear a survey result and you tend to think, oh, yeah, I kind of figured that. But if we just step back a minute, 82% of the state feeling hopeful. You know, when we embarked upon this survey back in August, it was a real question. You know, there's a lot going on in the state, and how anxious are Minnesotans? Is it more of a feeling of fear and anxiety in the state, or what is really going on? And so I just wanted to mark that and make sure that we all kind of take that in. 82%.
And you reminded me of the fact that here in the newsroom, and we're probably a bunch of jaded people here anyway, but we did our own little internal guess it. You know, you win a, I don't know, you gave away
that's,
some donuts.
That's right,
or
an internal poll.
None of us got close to 82%.
Right. Some of the people who know the state the best, the reporters here at Minnesota Public Radio, all thought that, you know, a higher proportion of the state would be fearful than the results as they did turn out.
But did you see some differences as you broke it down?
Yeah. Although, you know, one of the hypotheses that we're kind of testing with this survey is there a rural-urban divide, and what other divides might exist in the state? And I'm here to declare today that instead of a rural-urban divide, there's a rural-urban consensus on hopefulness here in the state.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, so that's fun to see.
What else?
Men and women, what do we think? Hopeful or more fearful among men versus women?
Yeah.
And it turned out equally the same. Both men and women are feeling pretty strongly optimistic about the future of our state.
So you mentioned that the urban-rural consensus is hopefulness, but there was still a difference in those numbers in terms of who, you know, whether you're in greater Minnesota or whether you're in the 7-county region here in the Twin Cities. I mean, yes, overall, it was still an overwhelming majority of hopeful respondents, but there was a difference and a split between that.
Yeah, that is true. As you know, we commonly divide up the state comparing greater Minnesota to the Twin Cities region, the 7-county region here in the Twin Cities. And when we looked at Greater Minnesota, about 73% said hopeful versus the Twin Cities, where 89%. So there's and the flip side of that is that about a quarter of those in Greater Minnesota expressed that they were fearful about the future of the state.
So is this trying to give the impression, as I talked to Craig Helmstetter here from the APM Research Lab, I mean, you hear these numbers. I mean, I don't want to necessarily give the impression that it's all hunky-dory, right? The presence of hopefulness doesn't equal the absence of pessimism, right?
Right. As I was talking to some of the guests who will be weighing in on this later in the show, you know, just because you're hopeful does not mean everything's rosy. You may have great hope that things will improve, even if you're in a difficult situation. But you know, this is a question that tries to get at the sentiment of the state overall, counterposing hopefulness and fearfulness. And it's great to see this high level of hope.
Now, were there other questions related to this that you dived into? Is this the one thing you'd like to see changed? Is that mirrored in this survey?
Yeah, and I think Eric McKinley's here, and he'll talk more to these open-ended responses later. But we did ask this broad open-ended question about if there is one thing that you would like to see changed in Minnesota, what would that be? And we crossed a lot of different recommendations there. It's interesting to really see the variety of things that people recommend. But overall, two big areas. One of them has to do with politics, you know, whether people wanted to throw out the party that they didn't like, or they'd like to throw out the governor that they didn't like, or keep the governor that they loved, and so on. So that's one broad category. Another has to do with taxes. I think Eric will speak to this as well. But the single most common specific recommendation we got in that area was just lower my taxes.
Lower my taxes. So the question here that I want to dive into this hour, and we have some guests here, but I definitely want to hear from you as well. When you think about Minnesota, are you generally hopeful or fearful about the future? That is word for word how the question was posed in this survey. Statistically speaking, you were probably not one of the 1,600 people we called, so call now. This will be your avenue to share your thoughts. 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. You can also tweet me at WeberTom1, and please don't call or text if you're driving. Craig Helmstetter, thanks so much for being here. I appreciate it. We're going to see more results this week from you. A lot of stuff online at nprnews.org. Thanks for being here.
Great, Tom. Thanks a lot.
I'm turning now to Eric McKinley, Eric Garcia McKinley, who works here at NPR. And you had the enviable task of looking through, I guess what, at the end of this survey, you could just... It was an open mic night. You could say whatever you wanted.
Right, exactly.
What were the themes you found, especially around this hopeful, fearful question?
Well, the question was about change. So the question, is there one thing you would like to see changed in Minnesota to improve our state? What would that be? So it's a really, really broad question. So it was hard to connect hope to that because really we're asking something that you find a lack in or something that people would find that would need to be improved. But where I saw hope in these responses was really in education. Education is one of the big themes that came up in these responses. And I found hope there because a lot of people said things like more investment in schools, more funding for higher education. And so to me, that sort of spoke to an investment in the future. So in this change question, this change open-ended question, that's really where I saw hope.
We are talking about a big survey of results here that we're diving into and will be over the next couple days as well, a lot at nprnews.org as well. The question we want to pose to you, when you think about Minnesota, are you generally hopeful or fearful about the future? 1-800-242-2828. So we brought in some other guests here that we shared the results with ahead of time to offer their thoughts. We want to hear from you, though, for sure this hour. We wanted to talk to people who talk to people and to try to get a sense like the survey of how people feel in this state. Lori Sturtevant is an editorial writer and columnist at the Star Tribune. Lori, it's good to see you again. Thanks for being here.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
I'm so glad you're here. Chuck Marone, founder and president of Strong Towns based in Brainerd. Chuck, by the way, married to my colleague Kirsty Marone, who also did some reporting for this series. But Chuck does a lot of traveling throughout the state and the country, and I definitely wanted to get his take on what he sees from his work. So, Chuck, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Anthony Galloway, CEO of Dare to Be Real, which works with students on racial equity issues. And you hear him regularly here on NPR on Counter Stories. Anthony, it's good to see you again.
Good to see you, too.
I want to get your initial thoughts, and I'll just do a kind of quick round robin. Lori, I'll start with you overall here on this question.
Tom, I'm excited by these results. I'm delighted to see how hopeful Minnesotans are. I think that's been part of the Minnesota character since statehood, since 1858, this notion that this is a place of opportunity where good things can happen, and also the sense of agency that as individuals, we can do something to make our world, our lives better. I think that's embedded in these responses. It's great to see these numbers this high.
Chuck?
I concur, although I don't want to be the downer right off the bat here, but
Go for it.
I do think that it's important to point out that, you know, if you would ask this question during the depths of the Depression, people generally said they were hopeful back then, too. I think there's a lot of state of mind in terms of, you know, the optimism of the future. Mm-hmm. And I just think Minnesotans in general tend to be people who maybe the glass is half full instead of half empty.
And that's actually something you and I talked about over the weekend, Anthony, about this. That word hopeful is an important word to dive into.
Yeah, I mean, the results aren't actually surprising just looking from the community standpoint within communities of color in particular, because the treatment of hope is not one that's dualistic in nature, right? So in the worst of everything happening around, we have 450 years of evidence within the Black community of folks remaining hopeful in the presence of a whole lot of horrible things happening around. So the results weren't necessarily surprising, and the semantic dance around the word hopeful mm-hmm. is actually one that I struggled with in looking at the results.
And you were not one of the people we called. So if they had called up, you know, out of nowhere, right, you get this phone call and the question is posed, hopeful or fearful about the state, I do wonder about, oh, well, I'm getting dinner ready and they're asking me whether I'm hopeful, you know, that kind of moment when you're taking the survey, what the reaction might be.
And I guess the point I would make is, regardless of whether I'm making dinner or my house is burning or any of this stuff like that, at some point when you ask me that question, I'm probably going to get an answer, and especially in my cultural upbringing, that hope is going to be high in that number as well.
Well, and Blacks are more hopeful than whites in this survey. 93% mm-hmm. of Blacks in this survey are hopeful. 82% are white. In the way that the question was asked. Say more about that. How do you think that would have changed answer?
I'm a seminarian right now, so this is also part of the conversation there and there. But one of the conversations that my family and I had is because of the tradition, particularly the Black church tradition, whether you are religious or not, that cultural carryover has made it into the zeitgeist of culture as well. So the idea that I would not find something to be hopeful about, no matter what question, no matter what setting that I'm in, whether it's Golden Time Coffee Shop or family dinner table, we can talk about all the things that is wrong with the world. But at any point in that conversation, when you ask, are you hopeful about where we could be? My answer is probably going to be yes.
Chuck.
Let me just say, too, I think if we were to go back a year ago and ask people, are you hopeful? I think you would have probably got a different response. I think people would have been less hopeful a year ago simply because we were in this big national contortion, this huge debate we were having.
We were 2 days or a week after the election.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I think once things are settled, I think once you get to a point where, okay, we've got a period of time now where we're going to be here, I think your mind resets and you start to focus on, okay, how do we make the best of this? How do we move on from this? So my theory would be, like, if we went back a year ago and asked people, we would have got a different response.
Thoughts,
well, that could well be. But I want to respond to what Anthony was saying. I think that is true in lots of faith communities mm-hmm. in Minnesota. And you're right, that has spilled outside the faith community. Mm-hmm. This cultural norm that we shall be hopeful. But how wonderful that has persisted, even in the face of the bruising election campaigns and all the other things that have been set loose to try to divide us from one another in Minnesota.
Well, to the point Craig made and Anthony had made to me in some emails over the weekend, it doesn't mean that we get a pass on these yawning gaps in the state, Lori, that you've written so much about in the pages of the Star Tribune, right?
Well, and I'm not surprised to see that in this big question, this overarching question that you asked about hopefulness versus fearfulness, that there is a regional divide that has appeared. It's not so big that it is alarming, but there is definitely something there that I think we need to acknowledge and address. It spills over into our politics. It spills over into our ability to function in state government. And state government is a big deal in Minnesota. So to have a dysfunctional state government is something we really want to avoid.
You know, we go back and forth, Chuck, on how to talk about where there are perceptions and actual differences in greater Minnesota and in the urban settings. And then you also see a governor's race already underway where they are using it. That is already part of the campaign. We can't get away from it. Even if we try to be thoughtful on how we step into that, what would you add to that conversation about exploring and exploiting the rural-urban thing here in Minnesota?
It's a really hard one because the business model of rural Minnesota is not a viable one long term. We've gone through decades of change, and we can put this under the rubric of globalization if we want. I think that was how it was put in our last presidential campaign, and you can bring in immigration and a whole bunch of things under that rubric as well. But that model of economy doesn't work long term in small towns and rural areas. It is a dramatic shift, and it changes the essential power structures and wealth structures of rural communities in ways that urban areas are not seen. So there's a certain level of insecurity that just exists because of this transition. I don't know how it will play out. I really don't know how to solve it in the sense that there is a simple solution to it. But it's an anxiety that exists that I think politically is easy to tap into.
We have the question here was worded on the survey. When you think about Minnesota, are you generally hopeful or fearful about the future? And we want to hear from you as well as we visit with Chuck Barone and Lori Sturdivant and Anthony Galloway. Eric Garcia McKinley from NPR is also here reading through some of the results from the survey. Give us a call, 1-800-242-2828. And let's first go to Steve, who's in Grand Marais. Hi, Steve. What would you say? How would you answer that question if I had just called you up? In general, are you hopeful or fearful about the future?
Okay. How can you be optimistic for the state of Minnesota when a single individual, the governor, can unfund one-third of our constitutional government by unfunding the legislature?
So you would vote fearful, it sounds like, Steve. You're making a comment about the current legal battle over funding for the legislature. Get in there, Lori.
Certainly, Steve, a reason to be concerned, but that is also a situation where we have a third branch of government, the courts, that have begun to act. They haven't completed their work. They've got more to do, in my opinion. But this is not a problem that is at a dead end, an impasse. There will be more steps. And just the fact that we have that kind of system, I think, is a reason to be hopeful.
Eric, is something sparking you from the survey results we had?
Yeah, and in the question about change, I mean, specifically the governor, that was one thing a lot of people mentioned. Yeah. Politics was the second most, politics was the most common response, something that fit into the category of politics, and changing the governor was the highest within that category.
I'm just wondering, that question makes me think about the representation in the sample itself. So in that, if I'm in a place where I'm more exposed to some of those decisions that can be made at that level, but what does that exposure look like in urban settings, in urban communities where the situations or the issues that are front and center might be different? That still might be a concern, but it might be further down the list on the things. It might be, there may be other things that are more pressing in that space. And so it just that question made me curious about particularly what some of the different things that kind of bump up to the top of the list for challenges in different parts of the state.
It's fascinating because the call was from Grand Marais, which I would put as one of like the top five most resilient communities in the state. One of the few, like the least affected by what happens in St. Paul. You're talking about a very remote place, a very tight-knit community. Actually, a few years ago, I'm guessing this still holds, the highest concentration of PhDs per capita in the state. You've got a very unique place. I highly doubt that people there are generally that fearful of what happens in St. Paul.
You know, it's interesting, though, because Grammarie, as I understand it, has broadband. And that's a big issue in rural Minnesota and greater Minnesota. Is it something as simple as whether your community has broadband? Because I can tell you when I was in Ely doing some reporting around our 50th anniversary, they are calling, we need more broadband here. Is it something like that that's going to get that question answered differently?
My gut says no, but I mean, possibly, yeah. I mean, I think it's one of those indicators of success. I mean, I think in cities like Grand Marais, in cities like Ely, one of the deep cultural tensions is that there's not a business model for young people to stay there. If young people are going to stay in a place like Ely after they graduate from high school, it's generally a sign of them not being successful. So in some ways, broadband expands those opportunities and allows, you know, more. But I don't think it solves that underlying problem.
I'd like to add that I am appreciating the caller Steve's mm-hmm. interest in this problem. It speaks to the way in which Minnesotans instinctively look to St. Paul, look to the state government to be an ally in addressing the issues of life and moving forward. To have the state government become even more dysfunctional than it has been in recent years would be of concern to people. And it's a real concern that we need to safeguard the functioning of state government. This particular problem, I'm quite convinced, will pass one way or another fairly soon.
You're talking about the funding issue.
The funding issue that Steve raised, caused by the governor's veto of the legislature's budget. I think one way or another that's going to get addressed. However, keeping state government able to play its role in our society, that's a big deal.
I just want to point out that Steve contextualized for us how he's viewing hope, right? Because he gave the issue for which he's just answering that question. But if you were to ask him a question about something else that connects to Grand Marais, that answer might be very different. And therein lies the struggle for me, especially when something around 75 to 80% of the people in Minnesota, of people of color in Minnesota, reside in very specific places in the state. And where is that in representation in proportion to your sample size of 1,600?
Oh, you're saying yes, because we definitely weighted by race and by geography, mm-hmm. Et cetera, but you're saying within the weighting, how many of those respondents were in this particular community, like Rondo and St. Paul, or that particular community where there are higher concentrations? Is that what you meant?
Only in so much as the context for which the question of hopefulness is asked. Mm. I still believe that the numbers would be pretty similar, because folks will lean into that hope first, at least for my community. But the context, as Steve brings up, his was contextual to the governor's power in terms of the state funding. But you ask that in a different context, you might get a different answer.
Let's go back to the phones here. Sue is in Brooklyn Park. How would you answer the question, Sue? Hopeful or fearful?
Oh, I'd say very hopeful. I'm 65. I've seen this go on for years and years and years. And there's always some stabilizing factor that reappears, you know, in the state government. And again, if you compare state government now to federal government, we're pretty stable. No matter what you think, we're pretty well educated. We, I think, are hopeful just because we've seen the cycles and things go in cycles. And Minnesotans are just generally pretty upbeat.
So been there, done that is Sue's impression there. Lori, by age, when we broke it down by age, the youngest and the oldest, the youngest from 18 to 34 and then the oldest over 65 are the most hopeful. Each of those age groups clocked in at 89%. Hopeful, and so the 35 to 64 brought us down to the 82.
That encompasses the big bulges in our population. Then the baby boomers continue to be a big, very big generation in Minnesota. In Minnesota, Generation X, which follows the baby boomers, was a smaller group. Birth control became widely available in the early 1960s, and I think it was a big hit in Minnesota because Generation X is smaller. And then comes the baby boomers' kids, the millennials. That's your young cohort, and they are now the largest generation in Minnesota.
And by age was so interesting, Eric, especially when we were talking about change and hopefulness as well. Some really interesting responses there.
By age?
Yeah. Do we have that, or was it mostly just what people came in with?
It was mostly what people came in with here. Yeah,
very good. What were you?
If you're not young and hopeful, like what's going on?
What are you doing?
Right. But I do think that this is a fascinating split. If you were to go back, I think, and ask, and I'm hypothesizing here, but if you were to ask a baby boomer, someone who's 65 today, like Sue was, back in 2008 or 2009,
right,
were they hopeful? I think at that point there's a lot of terror in that group. All of a sudden you had their mortgage, their home values dropping significantly.
Right.
Who are they going to sell this huge asset to? This is what they were planning on for their retirement. A lot of them were losing their jobs, and the opportunity to get gainful employment in that age demographic was very challenged. I think what you see is over the last 8-9 years, we've done a lot to prop up that group. And I think it's interesting that in that middle group, the Gen Xers, that's where you see the tension. That's where you see people struggling to pay for college. That's where you see people struggling to get into a home or to get out from underwater of a home yet. And so I think that that split is a very eye-opening one in terms of maybe what, you know, the future portends here.
It's so interesting, though, because you talk about the millennials being the largest segment of our population now. So as they age into what is now the dip in our results, it'll be interesting to see if that continues, Anthony.
Well, the question that just keeps coming to mind is for who? With the state with the largest gaps racially across multiple sectors, we still are finding the responses coming back from folks represented in that gap as positive, as hopeful.
Right.
All right. And so, again, I'm still challenged in the contextual dance that's happening with the way that this question is asked. What can we really pull? General positivity, yes. Can I ride that sail into some greater conversations and use that and capitalize on that? Great. But much more than that, what can we really say? Because the context varies, as it varied with both callers that just came in.
It's an interesting point, too, Anthony, because the APM Research Group, which is in its first year of existence here at NPR, I'm sure they're looking for ideas on how to change the survey, update the survey. They want good ideas, too. Do you see the way of wording a question in the spirit of this theme that might attract a different kind of
not a
answer?
Singular one. I think the major work is going to happen in the analysis of some of the contextual questions from that to look at that. And it's going to be more work, but also shifting semantically. So, for example, a Black Lives Matter protest in the middle of St. Paul. Is that a demonstration of pessimism? A lot of folks may say yes, but in terms of community conversation, that is actually a demonstration of hope. I'm not going to do all this work for if I don't have hope that there is possible change. Likewise, have a conversation with students in St. Anthony, New Brighton right now who are about to lead their fourth community dialogue around race with police, fire, all these folks who we assume are contentious, but yet they're cutting through that and actually coming to the table for some conversation. They would say they're pretty hopeful, even though their challenges are huge.
Anthony, and so that's an interesting point, Lori, for you and me who write about this and are in the journalism side of things. You know, what is new is usually stuff that is where the heads are bumping. Anthony makes such a good point that even though we're talking about the conflict, the underlying tone could still be one of a general hopefulness.
Well, absolutely. I think it is when people feel that they have some control, some ability to make a difference one way or another, move the needle in a desired direction, that produces a sense of hope. And it's a good thing for democracy when people feel that way. So indeed, I think it's very possible that people who were able to express some unhappiness over a terrible event that happened in our community were able to do so in a way that generated a sense of that maybe we can make this better. That's a good thing to have.
And I actually think that's a big part of this age shift. Just in general, if you look at people, I mean, I'm in my mid-40s. If you look at people who are in my demographic, that Gen X, you've got a job, you've got a mortgage, you've got kids. Your ability to kind of change where you're at is very limited now for a decade or two. If you are 65, like the caller Sue was, if you are a millennial, the world's more wide open for you. You can adapt to a lot more things. There's a lot more options for you on the table. So I'm guessing that part of this the shift in age is just a fact of life. It's just where you're at in the in the evolution of your life.
So does that mean though that the millennials, once they get the mortgage and the
kids, they'll feel feeling depressed. They'll have their midlife crisis. They'll say, they'll be like, oh, I'm stuck now. I got a job and a mortgage and car payments, and I can't go hang out at the place anymore. So
at the place anymore. Chuck Marone is with me from an organization called Strong Towns. Lori Sturtevant from the Star Trib. Anthony Galloway, CEO of Dare to Be Real. You also hear him on Counter Stories as well. Let's go back to the phones as we're asking this question. When you think about Minnesota, are you generally hopeful or fearful about the future? Mick in Minneapolis. Hi, what are your thoughts today?
Well, basically, it's pretty simple. I think for the most part, it's hopeful for the folks who are prepared to take advantages of opportunities, meaning that if you have an education or a work experience or some sort of trade, then it's hopeful for you because you're positioned to take advantage of the opportunities that are out here, which there are plenty, especially in Minnesota. And for those folks who are not prepared, you know, there's still opportunities for people to get jobs in general, but in order for you to thrive and really prosper and get ahead and get the jobs to where you look forward to going to work every day, you may not be able to take advantage of those opportunities because you don't have either the work history or the education, and especially for other folks, too, if you have, like, a criminal background and things like that. So there's it runs the gamut. But at the end of the day, in general, are there opportunities? Are there things for people to get up in the morning and be excited about in Minnesota? On average, yes. The answer to that question is yes for me.
Mick, thanks so much for the thoughts there. Anthony, in the story we had this morning introducing this during Morning Edition, Catherine Richard had talked to a guy who had been laid off, but he was already in the classes, completely different. He was going to become an accountant. So he was hopeful. He says, I see where I'm going next.
Well, it just as the caller was speaking, it just reminded me of the conversation, the mantra that was given for me and my family over and over and over again. No matter how hard things are going to get, and we had a spiritual background, so we're men of faith, and so, you know, a change going to come, you know, to borrow from Sam Cooke. So even though I may contextually have really horrible outcomes or experiences in all of these different places, the way that this question is asked kind of presupposes me to go just personally for my own cultural upbringing to the place where I have hope.
Eric?
Can I ask you a question, Anthony? Do you think that there's a sort of a privilege of pessimism for the white respondents who said they were less hopeful than black respondents?
There's not enough information there to actually respond to that cogently, but what I'll say is, again, it's the contextual dance that's going to give us more data. That's my belief. Hopeful about, and then whatever you fill in there, we got to do the hard work of figuring out all those different ways of asking that question, and then you'll get some different answers.
You can check out the entire Ground Level survey at mprnews.org/groundlevel. Let's go back to the phone. Beth is in Kettle River. Good morning, Beth. Thanks so much for calling.
Good morning.
What are your thoughts here today?
That I am one of those hopeful people.
Good.
I wanted to answer back to a comment that was earlier made about the people of, you know, like rural towns like Ely and Grand Marais, and how they have no hope of getting out of that town. And in fact, like I live in an area where our school is 17 miles away from where we live. So we go, you know, quite a ways to school.
Yeah.
But the graduation rate is 98%. And of those, nearly half of them are already halfway done with their college degree before they're done with high school, because they have the opportunity to do online or off-campus courses. And those people are not trying to leave the community. Hmm. What they're trying to do is they're trying to stay in the community to keep it strong. The goal is not.
Oh, are you there?
I am.
Oh, yeah. So you dropped out for a minute there. So finish your sentence.
Sorry.
There. Yeah, go ahead.
Their goal is not to move away and go to the city. It's to stay in the rural community and work at the bank or the hospital or the school or the prison or MSOP or things like that, in order to support the community and stay in the community in which they grew up.
Beth, I'm glad you called, and I'm glad you're hopeful as well. Lori was nodding along as you spoke there.
Well, I found Beth's call very hopeful, so thank you, Beth, for telling me that. I'm from a small town in South Dakota, just across the Minnesota line, and I see the same thing in that little town that Beth described. A belief in education still persists deep in the Minnesota culture, and a faith that education can be the tool that can allow us to continue to be community builders in our communities, whether that be the community of North Minneapolis or the community of Kettle Falls or Kettle River, Minnesota.
Yeah.
That's still very much a viable path. I hope it works for more people. Mm-hmm. One of the big concerning things that I discovered in the project I did 2 years ago was a very large education and attainment gap had developed between many rural counties in Minnesota, greater Minnesota counties, and the metro area. That's a dangerous gap. That's dangerous in lots of ways, but one of the big ways is that it's going to not allow people in greater Minnesota to participate in the modern economy to the extent that they should. So hallelujah that in Kettle River people can get a good start on a college degree while they are still in high school and have a chance to use the skills that they're learning to build their own communities.
There certainly isn't, and I think maybe she was responding to one of my comments earlier about getting out of Ely and Grand Marais.
Right.
Let me put it this way. I don't think that anybody has a difficult time getting out of Ely. Minnesota's done a great job with education and giving people opportunities. I think one of the bigger problems if you're in Ely is that you want to keep some of that brain power there. Mm-hmm. And what are the opportunities for people? If you go to be an accountant, how many places are there to work as an accountant? Do you have to have someone retire before you can get a job? If you lose that job, is there another job that you can get, or are you forced to move mm-hmm. somewhere else? Small towns, the economic dynamic of small towns and rural areas is very, very different than the metropolitan Minneapolis-St. Paul area. There's far fewer opportunities. It changes how you approach work and how you approach those opportunities. Mm-hmm. And it changes the cultural dynamic in a way that creates a lot of stress and tension. And I think when we don't acknowledge that, when we think that the solution is just more education, I think we're missing a lot about what goes on in these small towns.
But on the one point, I think we would see population trends, including in Minnesota, show that overall, right, Kettle River notwithstanding, that overall numbers, as there are increases in population in the state, they are more likely to be concentrated in the metro.
That's right.
But is there not also a movement that this caller spoke to that I've had inklings of to say, well, we're going to do what we can in our small town to stem that and to stop that?
I think there is a budding movement of that. I think you can see it real clearly up on the Iron Range, where a lot of people are kind of taking an alternate path. But that path is not loaded up with college debt. That path is not, you know, I think the one we think of where the person goes off, gets a four-year degree, and then comes back to a parade and a big party. It's a different economic model, and I think that's what we need to start having a conversation around.
It's just interesting hearing the description of the experience and some of the challenges and wants of rural Minnesota. Those mirror almost specifically urban settings where folks are represented in this gaps, mm-hmm. these gaps that we continue to persist. And so I find it interesting contextually that some of the same challenges we're seeing put forward there in terms of wanting to stay in community, wanting to be able to work in community, the education, all those pieces are mirrored in urban city spaces. But I only really ever hear the narrative in the context of rural.
I have
outside of the community.
I'm so glad you brought that up, though, Anthony. There have been so many times on this show, and we've had whatever conversation about the topic, where you realize what are the issues that you care about, and you ask someone in greater Minnesota and in North Minneapolis, and it's the same.
It's the same.
I made a list. I was talking to the mayor of, I don't remember, some greater Minnesota, I think Granite Falls, and I read a list of things. Do you support this, 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 and this? And he said, yes. And I was reading the agenda list or the things we want to work on at the Capitol for an organization called Voices for Racial Justice.
It's an exercise that we do commonly in our racial discourse work with both in Dare to Be Real and some other circles where if you can take all the issues and just take the names off or the positions, the disposition off and put them side by side, they don't look a whole lot different. So what is really at the root of this versus that?
Anthony, yeah. I think it's a shame that we've had politics that has tried to divide us, to try to create the impression among especially greater Minnesota voters that the interests of the urban area are somehow different from mm-hmm. theirs. It's just not true.
Not true at all.
So being able to lift that up in this conversation today, good for us.
But I do think that there is a nuanced difference here. And I see it most clearly in cities like Ely and mm-hmm. rural small towns. There is a track for people who want to go, and we can just call it the professional route, people who want to get college degrees and people who want to plug into. And I think globalization, again, getting back to it, is maybe the rubric to think of this under. People who are benefiting from that type of an economy, whether as consumers or as professionals, have a very clear path in this state. People who are not in that system, people who struggle in that system or who it's not like a natural place for them to go, have a very different trajectory. And I don't think particularly in small towns and rural areas, we've figured that out. I don't know in the urban context, but I can tell you in small towns, if you're 20 years old and you're living in my hometown of Brainerd, something's wrong. Like, what has gone wrong? You should be gone somewhere else. Why are you there? What are you doing?
And now, when you say, why are you still here? That's wrong. Are you saying that that's the perception? That's the look you get in the coffee shop kind of a thing?
Yes and no. I mean, I think yes, the answer is yes, that's a perception. But the perception also has a basis in reality. What's your trajectory? What opportunities are presented to you? What path do you have to start with nothing where you're at and make something of yourself? I don't know as that path is really there the way that maybe it was 30 years, 40 years, 50 years ago for that demographic.
Let's go back to the phones here. John in St. Paul. Hi, John. What are your thoughts here today? Hopeful or fearful?
I want to say hopeful, Tom, but I'm leaning towards fearful. Just simply because there are a lot of opportunities. There are a lot of opportunities. And I'm from the St. Paul area, man, east side to be in particular. There are a lot of opportunities for people of color and the young people of color. We had two young mayors that we just elected, and they made a lot of promises. I think the only way we get there is we start holding these elected officials' feet to the fire. Mm-hmm. We can't keep having these community conversations and nothing comes out of them. You know, these community conversations are pretty much worthless. Nothing comes out of them if you're not fixing the problem. You're just conversating about them, if that makes sense.
Admiring the problem is the phrase I've heard, John.
And it's just an ongoing, like, we have so many conversations and so much dialogue. But in reality, if you want to change something, just wake up in the morning today and say, I'm going to change.
John, thanks so much for the call there, Anthony.
I just want to make a correlation between some of the things that you were saying in reference to rural Minnesota and some of the things that John was just saying. You know, we talk about urban. When we talk about rural versus urban, we're actually having three conversations. Rural, urban, and then the urban population who is represented in the conglomerate. But this is how you have, you know, Minneapolis being voted as the most livable city with these gaps that we know continue to persist. Mm-hmm. And so in that space, there's a lot of places contextually where you can find hopelessness. You know, I have a very similar feel in our urban context. And then I'm looking at a growing number of young, particularly Black professionals, just because that's the connection with. But folks who are like, you know what? I don't see a whole lot of opportunity to go through these systems that continues to have all these different gaps in there. What if I shift that on its head? And there's a growing body of Black entrepreneurs who are basically find an idea that's competitive right now. And let me just go do that myself. And I'm finding that community is growing a lot in my urban circle.
Didn't you do that yourself, Anthony?
Absolutely.
You just started your own business.
I was up in Virginia and met this woman, a young woman who had purchased a building in the downtown. People thought she was crazy. Mm-hmm. She bought this place. It was rather cheap. She was living in the upstairs. And her goal was to fix up the two downtown shops, the two shops beneath, and then rent those out and have some rental income. Mm-hmm. This was actually financially a pretty low burn kind of living. But it was not the kind of lifestyle that we, you know, she didn't go to college. She didn't get a mortgage. She doesn't have two car payments. It was a different type of building wealth and success. But if you look at that trajectory, that's actually the way people for thousands of years made it. They would start small with something and they would incrementally build it and they would end up with something substantial by the end.
And Virginia is such an interesting town because it still maintains the appearance and structure of one of those small town downtowns with the theater and everything
it's
there.
It's one of the places you can actually make that happen.
Absolutely.
It's one of the places where, and this is why I think the Iron Range right now today is a very exciting place, not because of all the mining investment that could potentially happen or the millions of dollars of subsidies that we could hand out, but because if you look at the core little towns, they're actually structurally solvent. You can actually start something from very little and build it up over time. And that's an opportunity that a certain slice, that non-participating in globalization slice has been taken away out of our system in most of our places, but it still exists there. And you see people starting to tap into it.
I think we should acknowledge that even as there are significant portions of our population that have the perception that they don't have much by way of opportunity, at the same time, we have a skills shortage and lots of industries crying for more workers. A worker shortage is going to be the sort of the dominant theme for the Minnesota economy for the next 10 or 15 years, judging by the demographics. So there is a potential here for opportunities to present themselves if we can provide people with more skills. Getting rid of making higher education more readily available, and I'm not talking necessarily about four-year degrees here, but talking rather about those skills, technical college and community college programs that get people into the workforce with a set of skills that makes them marketable, allows them to be either in their own location or someplace else. That's a real key for the success of Minnesota in the next 10 years.
We're talking about the results of a big survey from NPR News and the APM Research Lab. This is the first day of shows where we're diving into some of these survey results and the question we're pondering today. When you think about Minnesota, are you generally hopeful or fearful about the future? We have Lori Sturtevant here, who you just heard there from the Star Tribune, Chuck Marone from an organization called Strong Towns, and Anthony Galloway, who you hear on Counter Stories here on NPR, also heads a new company he just made, Dare to Be Real. And Andrew in Glendon, Minnesota, called in to say, Minnesota is optimistic. I moved around the U.S. I worked in the Army, and I think Minnesota is one of the best states for everything from education to health. It's interesting, Chuck, you also travel around the country. Do you agree with what Andrew says on that hopeful? Now, I get the education and health, but that hopeful point, are we just a more buddingly hopeful crowd?
We're bizarrely optimistic. Yeah. It's funny because I was
welcome to Minnesota, bizarrely optimistic. No, that'll be on all the signs.
I was in California last week, and I give these lectures and workshops and then take a Q&A. And in California, like, every question was a Debbie Downer kind of negative question. When I speak here in Minnesota and talk to people, there is a cultural and I can't really explain it. My family is a deep Norwegian. I remember my grandma, glasses half full kind of person. There might just be a cultural optimism to us. I mean, all our children are above average, right?
Right.
That kind of sense of who we are. But yeah, I was in Alabama last year, and I gave a day-long workshop, and we got kind of to the big Q&A part, and someone stood up, and I've never been asked this question before except for this. They said, how does Minnesota do it? How is your education system? So why do you guys, do things the way that you do? And the question was about us culturally. And I do think there is something to be said. I mean, we're on Minnesota Public Radio. We can pat ourselves on the back.
Sure.
Here. But, I do sense that there's something different about this place.
And with that, with our bizarre optimism, Anthony, in our final minutes here, I'm going to go back around the room. What do we do with that? What do we do with that to make sure we're still focusing on what we need to focus on, but then also realize that maybe we are a little bizarre?
For me, it's to not let hopefulness or that need to have hopefulness, I actually think it functions as a way to not talk about hard issues. And it can show up in many different ways. And so that's one of my concerns. I don't recall there being any black churches in Lake Wobegon. So, that piece that even though we might be talking about something that's hopeful and peachy, there's context and nuance that we often aren't talking about as well.
Lori, what would you add to that?
Well, I just think learning what the origins of our hope, and I think it just speaks to what Anthony was mentioning, the spiritual side of things. It speaks to our commitment to education, as Chuck has mentioned. It speaks to a concern for each other that is reflected in our healthcare policies. Learning what the origins of that sense is and then sustaining that. It's not a given that we're going to always be have this kind of outlook. And if we lose this, we're going to lose our capacity to make our lives better, I think.
Do you see what's happening in politics, what's happening on social media, specifically in politics, what's happening on which channels we decide to watch or who we decide to listen to, popping that balloon?
Well, I am maybe the most critical when I see candidates trying to pit one region of the state against the other in a political sense. I think we will do ourselves some real long-term damage if we continue with the current pattern and the metro area's population growth outstrips that of Greater Minnesota. If Greater Minnesota denies the urban area, the transit, and the other investments that it needs now, there will be a price to pay down the road. And I don't want that kind of regional rivalry to become our modus operandi at the state capital.
And you and I have talked about this, too. I'm from Illinois originally, and it is so skewed now with population that in the legislature in Illinois, they don't need the downstate votes.
Yeah.
They have so many seats in the House and Senate that they just do their Chicago thing. And they're done, and they don't need, because there's not enough population in the South. Is that on the horizon for us?
The Minnesota ethic needs to be we function together this has to be a conscious choice now. When I think in the past it was something that we kind of did automatically in Minnesota. There was such a natural connection between people who lived in Greater Minnesota and the Twin Cities. Now this has to be a conscious choice because this state will be stronger if we have a better economy for all.
I think if 2016 was about shouting, and maybe the first half of 2017 was about shouting.
Yeah, there's been some shouting in 2017,
yeah,
too.
And throwing bricks through windows and basically like getting people's attention. My hope for 2018, even though it's going to be an election year here, is that we spend a lot more time just listening. I think we as a culture would benefit a lot, as Minnesotans, from spending time listening and then trying to understand each other. There's a lot going on in this state. I do think the demographics are not going to be kind to Greater Minnesota. And I think it would benefit Greater Minnesota to listen to the metro. I think it would benefit the metro hugely to listen to Greater Minnesota. And I don't know if the political lens is the way we do that. I think it's going to take people like Anthony. Yeah. It's going to take, you know, a different conversation to actually make that happen.
It's a nice reminder to us, too, because Lori and I always want to think about this in a political landscape and a lens, and we can't do that.
No, our politics are going to make it way more dysfunctional because there's a benefit short term for doing that. I think culturally, if we want to stay the best of what we have in Minnesota, if we want to expand Lake Wobegon, which I think is a great concept.
Mm-hmm. Open the Black Church in Lake Wobegon.
Yeah, I think we have to, I think we got to take the time to listen a lot more.
We have a lot more online as well. You can check out the entire ground level survey at nprnews.org/ground level. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about trust in institutions. We're going to focus on police and news media. And then on Wednesday, we're going to talk about what's called a right track, wrong track question, which is a very common kind of question in a survey. And we asked a lot of people whether Minnesota is on the right track or wrong track in blank. We're going to focus on immigration on this show on Wednesday. But throughout NPR News' coverage, you'll see a lot more coverage of some of these ancillary topics as well. Thank you all for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Lori Sturtevant from The Strib, Chuck Marone from Strong Towns, and Anthony Galloway. You'll hear him on Counter Stories as well. Thanks all for being here.